Welcome to the Innovation in Financial Inclusion podcast. I'm Andrew Wallace.
I'm Paul Vick, and we're from Community Finance Solutions at the University of Salford. Community Finance Solutions is a research unit specializing in financial inclusion and affordable credit.
In this episode, we're talking about food cooperatives, which is a food distribution outlet organised as a cooperative where decisions on the production and distribution of food is made by its members. Food is important from a financial inclusion point of view because it makes up over a fifth of low-income households' budgets.
To learn more about this topic, we've spoken with Dr. Celia Plender and Yolanda Barnsley. Celia is a lecturer at the University of Exeter and has conducted extensive research on urban grassroots food co-ops to understand their policies and their responses to social and political changes taking place around them. Yolanda is a food co-op project coordinator at St. Hilda's East Community Centre, which sells affordable fruit and veg to local residents in Shoreditch, East London.
Celia, to start off, what are food cooperatives?
Sure. So essentially a food cooperative is a community-run retail project. But, you know, the scope within that can be really quite broad. So it can be anything from a group of friends or neighbours coming together and setting up a buying group to a market stall or a veg bag scheme, or, you know, a full-scale shop. So, yeah, really quite broad. The logics, though, tend to be the same, and that's about bulk buying. You know, so it's about coming together, buying in bulk as a way of getting wholesale prices. So as a way of making food more financially accessible, essentially. And within the UK, they've actually got really a pretty long history. You know, if we go back to 1844, the Rochdale pioneers are sort of very much seen in the UK context as the founders of the cooperative movement. You know, and their principles actually are still really fundamental to the cooperative movement around the world. And with them, they were a group of working class people in the northwest of England in Rochdale who came together, you know, in this way to benefit from bulk buying. You know, this was a time where the economy, the industry was really, really changing. You know, a lot of them were craftspeople. They were people who, you know, the mechanization was really having an impact on their livelihoods. Food at this time tended to be monopolised by small shopkeepers who charged a lot of money. There were lots of issues around food adulteration as well. You know, so there were lots of reasons why they were thinking about sort of how to change their lives, really, how to make food more accessible, how to make their finances more viable. And so, yeah, through cutting out the middlemen and going straight to the wholesalers, they were able to make food more accessible to them. They were able to have more bargaining power in the market, and they were also able to ensure better safety in terms of what they were doing. And there was also sort of a political aspect to this in the sense that typically a cooperative is something that is member owned and member organized. You know, so people are making decisions about how it runs. Everyone involved is making decisions about how it runs. You know, so there's this democratic component that's really important too. But you can see there's sort of a lot of different things going on in terms of both the very practical and pragmatic, but also the more sort of ideological and sort of skill learning and things like that. Since then, it's often sort of suggested that there have been two further waves of food co-ops. So one is during the counterculture of the 1960s and 70s. And there, you know, food became a mechanism to sort of explore some of those countercultural values and ideals, and thinking about sort of alternatives to the mainstream system. And so, you know, so a lot of food cooperatives set up just as much as people went back to the land and people started growing their own food. So, you know, you could grow your own food, but you couldn't grow everything, right? So the food co-op was the place where you could go and get your whole foods. You know, they were also places to share information about the ideologies of the counterculture. And then in terms of the third wave, this is much more recent. So we're thinking probably into the sort of 1990s onward here. And there's sort of different components to this. So this is quite tied up, just as the counterculture is tied up with environmentalism. So is the sort of more recent wave of food co-ops. You know, quite a few of them have been thinking about, you know, how do we do a food system differently? You know, what role can consumers in this case, you know, because obviously we're thinking about small retail projects which consumers are involved with, you know, how can consumers have a say in the way the food systems run? How can consumers have a different relationship with producers and things like that? You know, so we get these different components. Post 2008 and the financial crisis, you know, in particular, this was a time where people were really sort of questioning how the economy was run, how the food system was run, all of these sorts of big things, you know, the content of neoliberalism, all of this stuff was sort of really under consideration. And food co-ops was one of the mechanisms through which people were reflecting on those things. But then, of course, also post 2008, we see in countries like the UK, we see austerity come into play. And there too, you know, food co-ops became a way for people to sort of think through how to access food more affordably, you know, think about some of those practical dimensions as well as the ideological.
And sort of, you know, you've gone through the history of, you know, food co-ops, you know, from the 1840s to now. What do we know about these groups today, sort of like, and how widespread are they, and what are their sort of goals? I think you've just touched on the goals, but I don't know if you could expand a little bit further.
Sure. So today it's a really quite diverse picture. You know, so they can have quite diverse value structures, financial models, you know, even you know, if we think about the definition of a cooperative itself, which I touched on before, you know, so the International Cooperative Alliance defines a cooperative as a people-centered enterprise, owned, controlled and run for its members to realise their common economic, social and cultural needs and aspirations. But actually, in terms of the structures of contemporary co-ops, they don't necessarily always run in that way. So they're cooperative in name more than they necessarily are in organizational structure. And one of the reasons for this is that there has actually been quite a bit of policy interest around food cooperatives over the years, especially since the 1990s, in terms of sort of the increasing interest in things like five a day and bringing fresh fruit and vegetables, nutritionally you know, healthy foods into areas of deprivation, for example. Community initiatives have often centered around this idea of the food cooperative, and that would often be something that was facilitated by stuff like local primary primary healthcare trusts and things like that. So, you know, this sort of interaction between more official state mechanisms and community groups, you know, and with those sorts of things, often there'd be a paid coordinator, but then a lot of volunteers involved as well. And so you get this very different structure around decision making and an organisation, but you still at the heart of it get this sort of concern around community action and this concern about accessible food. So that's sort of one strand that has really come into play in more recent years and sort of diversified what a food co-op is and sort of what they're doing. But as I said, you know, you do really get quite a diverse range of activities that are happening under the banner of food co-ops. You know, so you get some projects which are very much looking at that issue of accessible food, nutritionally sound food. You know, bringing certain kinds of healthy foods into areas where they're less accessible. But you also get some which are more focused on things like you know, organics and fair trade, and again making those more accessible, so making certain other kinds of foods more accessible in areas, you know, and that's often because there's a community or group of people there that's particularly interested in those foods. You know, some projects will be trying to manage both of these things at the same time, and then it's about giving people choice, you know, not assuming that people in areas don't want access to let's say organic foods, you know, giving them that choice, letting them decide how they manage their budgets and what they prioritize in terms of what they buy. So yeah, you can see there's really a lot of diversity. You know, they're also thinking about the issue of financial sustainability. You know, how do we, especially, you know, some food co-ops are very, very reliant on funding. You know, how do we keep food affordable, but also stop being so reliant on funding? Because obviously, if funding dries up, project can close. And then, you know, what do the people who've been involved with that project do? You know, how do they find their food and their community? You know, so there's quite interesting developments going on. But in general, you know, the UK has a pretty weak cooperative sector. It's despite that really strong cooperative history, we're at this moment where, as an idea, it doesn't seem to be quite as strong and buoyant as it is in some other countries. But, you know, nonetheless, cooperatives throughout history really have often been, you know, the cooperative idea has been something that resonates with people when they're experiencing needs or when there are particular kind of crises going on. So I think we are at an interesting moment as well in terms of food co-ops.
And I don't know if you could sort of just expand on who are the sort of members, you know, what are the demographic of members in food cooperatives in the UK today?
Sure. It's really variable, actually. It really depends on the project. It depends on the area that it's in. And, you know, I think often we might assume that, for example, if a co-op is focusing on access to things like organic and fairly traded foods, it's going to be a middle class white demographic. And I would say some of that can play out, but it's not necessarily always the case. You know, so there's one particular co-op in Southeast London that I've worked with for many years, and it's been running for many, many years. It was started by anarchists and squatters. It's run entirely by volunteers on a non-hierarchical basis. You know, it has consensus decision-making processes. It supplies fairly traded and organic food primarily, and whole foods and things like that. You know, so sort of it could have these associations of a very sort of white middle class project, right? But it's in an area that has always been diverse and is still diverse. It's an area that's gentrifying, but, you know, there's still lots of different kinds of people in the area, you know, and certainly with some of the participants there, some of the people that volunteer there and some of the people that shop there, you know, talking to them about what brought them there. You know, certainly there's been people who've said to me, austerity brought me here. You know, I can't access everything in the co-op. I can't afford everything in the co-op. But, you know, certain things like the grains and the whole foods, because of the bulk factor, they're accessible to me and they're more affordable to me than they are elsewhere. You know, so people do mix and match with their shopping always, you know, and with other projects as well, with some of the ones that I've worked with in Tower Hamlets, they have really diverse groups of people volunteering and groups of people coming to shop. You know, a lot of the areas that I work have worked in are urban. A lot of them are dealing with different forms of gentrification, you know, and interestingly, these co-ops are often places where actually different kinds of people do come together, you know, and that for a lot of them is really quite important in part of this, as part of this idea of accessibility, because it's not about siloing certain people or saying, no, this is only for certain kinds of people. It's about thinking about inclusion and thinking about, you know, the power of all being in the same space and having the same shopping experience, rather than saying, no, only people on lower incomes can come here because this is targeted at you. It's sort of saying, no, we're all part of something. We're all part of a community. And so, yeah, pretty diverse.
And then what does the existing evidence tell you about, you know, the effectiveness of food cooperatives in reducing, you know, food bills and in combating food poverty?
I think, in all honesty, it's a complex picture. So my work hasn't been so much around measurement. So it's qualitative work that I do as an anthropologist. But talking to people involved, even the people who are sort of coordinating and running co-ops, you know, At times, so for example, if we think about the sort of fresh fruit and vegetable focused food co-ops that are often areas of deprivation, you know, typically, especially in places like East London, you get you still have market stalls that are selling fruit and veg for a pound a bowl, you know, and a co-op can't really compete with that necessarily in terms of price always, you know, but it sort of offers different things, you know. So often when people talk about that stuff, you know, they'll say, well, we're not in a food desert, there is food available here, but we're thinking about what kind of food is available. You were thinking about the fact that the fresh fruit and vegetables at the food co-op are probably going to last longer. You know, you can manage your own budget as well, because you don't have to buy a large amount. You can decide exactly how much you want, you know, and that tends to be the case across lots of different co-ops. Equally, if we think about the Whole Foods co-op, you can decide how much you want to buy because you're weighing out your own goods, you know, so you can decide what your wallet will stretch to. And it might not stretch to sort of a supermarket size bag of something, but maybe you've got enough money for a particular portion that you weigh out. And so you're managing your own finances in those sorts of ways. I mean, as I've sort of mentioned before, certainly there are lots of people who have thought out these co-ops because they are finding them financially accessible, and they're finding that they're helping them to manage their own finances. A lot of people will mix and match as well. So there's certain things that they feel like they know they can get cheaper at the co-op, but they might get other things elsewhere. You know, shoppers are savvy, right? Especially shoppers on low income are very savvy about how to manage their finances and how to sort of navigate some of that stuff. So it's certainly a complex picture rather than something that we can say in a blanket way that they're always providing cheaper food and always solving issues around food access. But you know, but they're certainly, I think they're doing, for the people involved, they're doing really important work, and they're supporting them not only in terms of food access, but actually in all sorts of other ways as well, which I think is really important to remember. So these are food spaces, you know, these are spaces where retail interactions are being done differently, and a lot of people value that non-profit dimension to the kind of co-ops that I work with. But there are also spaces where, you know, in the context of inequality, in the context of things like austerity and the cost of living crisis, that there's an ethos around valuing people differently. There's an ethos around care and support and community. And all of those things, you know, I think are really, really resonant as well, and really important to remember in terms of how these sort of small grassroots projects are running and what they're trying to do. You know, and there can also be flexibilities, you know, so sometimes depending on the project, there might be times where someone gets something for free, or there might be times where it's like, okay, I know this person really well, and I know that they're really struggling with something, and there might be discrete ways of supporting particular people at particular times in a way that doesn't feel stigmatizing or judgmental, and in a way that can be very discreet. So like, there's a lot of different stuff going on, but I think that issue of sort of how people are valued, how people are cared for, and how people come together is actually just as fundamental as the cost of food within these projects.
Thank you, Celia. Now moving on to Yolanda at St Hilda's. Yolanda, what does St Hilda's do?
So St Hilda's East Community Centre is based in Shoreditch, East London, and it has established a model that strives to increase provision and access to healthy, affordable, fresh fruit and vegetables to the local community on a weekly basis. It also aims to raise awareness of environmental issues around food and reduce the environmental impact of the food purchased, because we source the majority of our produce locally. About a third of the fruit and vegetables we have on offer is organic from a farm in East Essex called Sarah Greens. And then 75% is non-organic, and that's sourced from New Spitalfields Market, which is just down the road from us. So that's not locally grown, but it's locally sourced and helping sort of reduce the food supply chain and minimize carbon footprints. But essentially, we try to increase provision to that affordable fruit and vegetables to local community, and it's culturally appropriate, but it's also a lot more diverse than any of the kind of fruits and vegetables on offer in local supermarkets in the area. And we're actually based in an area which is categorised as a food desert. So, yeah, it's quite important.
And so you spoke that you've established this sort of model. I don't know if you could sort of expand on how the model works. I know you've covered quite a bit there, but I don't know if you'd be able to expand on how that model works.
Of course. So it's essentially a pop-up shop. So that's the kind of style of the food cooperative that we've taken. And it's set up every Thursday between 11 and 2 and then packed down at the end of the day, which means we can then utilise the space in which it's set up for other activities. And it's based in a multi-purpose community centre. So it runs alongside other projects such as our Feeling Good Older People's projects, but also our advice services, our women's project. We have a creche. It's a very sort of diverse range of activities on our programme. And that means people who benefit from those projects can also shop in the food co-op. But then because it's an open access model, so it's not reliant on membership, it actually means anyone in the community can shop there. So it's not just our beneficiaries, but it's local residents on any income from any background. And this is one of our main sort of goals, actually, as the food cooperative, is to increase access to good quality fruit and veg for everyone, but to encourage social cohesion between different groups of people within a community space.
And you spoke earlier about, you know, you said the area you operate in is a food desert. Mm-hmm. Is that sort of the reason what came about the origins of this sort of the co-op? I don't know if you could sort of expand on the origins of when it started and why it started.
So it's been running for over 18 years now. I've been working on the project for about a year and a quarter, year and a half, and I support this project alongside the Women's Wellbeing Project. But it was set up about 18 years ago through another colleague who coordinated the project. But essentially, St Hilda's East Community Centre is based in and around an estate which is some of the first social housing in the UK. So this is why the organisation was established here. But that social housing, a lot of it has been privatised, but majority of it is still social housing. So having a food cooperative in this area where there is limited access to fresh, healthy, affordable fruit and veg is really essential. And so that's why it was set up originally. And it was previously set up and run alongside an organisation called Community Food Enterprises, which was also a social enterprise. So they were able to offer their delivery services where they sourced the non-organic produce from New Spitalfields Farm at a reduced price. And they had training opportunities for local people in the area to sort of get involved with the sourcing and learn and sort of have a wage alongside it. But it meant that our prices could be kept at sort of low cost, so then it doesn't translate or transfer onto the charity itself and we don't have to take up those costs. But this has actually changed within the past 6 months. Community Food Enterprise has had to stop working on that side of the business because they couldn't afford to do so with the increased cost of food, fuel, cost of living in general. So we've had to look elsewhere to find a new supplier for our non-organic produce, which is the majority of our range on offer. And this has meant that the model has had to take quite a big hit, and we're having to look at new ways to try and reduce costs. And so it's quite an interesting time for the food cooperative.
And so you spoke earlier about the fact that you don't really have members. It's quite open base of you know, anyone could come in from the local community. Could you sort of, I don't know, give a sort of a description of sort of what are the characteristics, what types of sort of members of the local community use your food co-op?
So in Tower Hamlets and Weavers Ward specifically, where we're based, we have the highest density in population of Bangladeshi people, and so a lot of our customers come from that cultural background and have lived here for a very long time. But then it It's multicultural, so that's why we try to offer a range of different produce which is specific to different cuisines and can be used in different dishes. And it ranges from people shopping who are sort of around 26, 35. Our most popular group is actually 36 to 45, but it goes up to beneficiaries who are sort of 75 plus. So it really varies there in terms of age. The majority of people do live within a 15-minute neighbourhood of the food co-op who shop here. So in our end of year reports, I think it revealed actually 79% of our participants live locally within that 15-minute neighbourhood. 18% are 15 minutes away by bike, whilst the rest are by foot. So people use sort of green modes of transport to get here as well. Only two participants actually reported using public transport to get to the food co-op. And in terms of background and sort of income, it really varies. We actually in the process of collecting more demographic data on our customer base, but the data we've collected so far reveals that the majority of people are around an income of sort of London living wage to 35k. Then there are a few people who shop at food co-op who are on a much significantly higher salary of 56 to 75k, but that's because we're based in an area which is experiencing quite extreme gentrification. So we have the social housing around us, and we're based in Tower Hamlets, which is one of the most deprived boroughs in London, but then we're right on the boundary of Liverpool Street, where there's a lot of business, and we're also in an area where there's a lot of designer shops which have moved in. And so people who shop here, they don't necessarily all live here. They either they might work here, for example, and that means they come on their lunch break, and their sort of background is slightly contrasting. But like I said, some of the social housing has also been privatised, so it's attracted different types of people.
Okay. And, you know, you've spoke earlier about that this offers, you know, the food co-op offers low cost food. But are there any sort of other sort of benefits for the local community for the food co-op? You might have already covered them off. I don't know if you'd be able to sort of even reiterate them.
Yeah. So basically the way that is run is I am the food co-op coordinator. So I sort of do the strategy and planning behind the project, support with sort of monitoring, evaluation, partnerships. And then I work alongside Cindy, my colleague, who's the food co-op facilitator, and she runs everything operationally. And she's supported by a team of volunteers who come in the morning, help set up, they do all the customer service, and they get involved with the whole operational running of the shop. And so one of the main benefits is actually providing some volunteering opportunities to the local community, where there's on-the-job work experience, training and mentoring provided to these volunteers. And quite a few of the people involved are local women, some who are unemployed. And so it's a good opportunity to get work experience put on CVs and support their careers. I also mentioned that it is based in the community centre, where we encourage sort of social cohesion. And so by getting people together in one space and having projects alongside the food cooperative, but running one-off events, such as the other week, we have received some funding from Cadent Energy, where we were able to distribute free slow cookers and carbon monoxide alarms. And we did this alongside the food cooperative. And so doing events like that really encourages people to come together, and we've strived to fight isolation often experienced by those who are disadvantaged or marginalised in the community. But we do also have a e-newsletter which we send out, and we have sort of posters around the food cooperative where we try to increase awareness around sort of healthy eating and vegetarian plant-based diet choices by sharing sort of recipe cards and sort of advice around different fruit and veg and what you can do with it and the nutrients inside.
And then, sorry, just going back towards when you were saying about, you know, your food co-op being, you know, offering low-cost food, how much would you say, I don't know if you have access to this information, but how much would you say that on average most people save from buying through your cooperative?
In terms of savings, we do supermarket price comparisons on a quarterly or 6 month basis, and on average it's about 15-20% cheaper than any of the local supermarkets, and that's based on sort of comparisons of individual prices of maybe tomatoes, potatoes, and then we do an average, and that's how much cheaper it is.
And then sort of just looking at the operational side, what would you say are the sort of key considerations in terms of setting up a food cooperative? I know you said you're helping to assist in setting them up, but what would you say are sort of the key considerations in setting a food cooperative up?
Yeah, so actually a few years ago, Sustain Food Alliance, I'm not sure if you know the organisation, they sort of created a food cooperative toolkit, which I think St Hilda's previous food co-op coordinator helped contribute some information to, and we're using that as kind of a framework to then adapt to our own and refine and improve. But the key kind of ingredients, you could say, to a food co-op would be storage. It's really essential to have adequate storage in terms of being able to keep the fruit and veg when it's delivered, but also manage surplus. And a lot of the fruit and vegetables obviously are perishable and will go off quickly if they're kept in warm temperatures, so having a fridge is also essential within that storage space. We have just started offering food, ambient good food donations alongside our food co-op from Felix Project, which is delivered to Tower Hamlets Food Hub. And it's really important that we have a storage space to be able to keep that as well, because, like I said, we work in a multi-purpose community centre and all of our rooms are used for different activities. So it's important we have it in a secured space and enough room to keep it all, because it's quite a lot of fruit and veg going in and out. I think from our research report last year, actually, we on average, our sales were close to 28,000, averaging £572 of fruit and veg sold a week, which amounts for the distribution of an estimated amount of 230 kilograms of fruit and vegetables passing in and out of the food co-op. So that's quite a lot of fruit and veg. But another sort of key element is sort of having structured sort of ordering systems in place. So you need to have good partnerships with the suppliers that you're working with. And so we have a long-lasting relationship with Sarah Green's Farm. As I said, they supply our organic range, and we actually get it delivered to us on a Wednesday morning, and we share that delivery with a local shop around the corner which also sells organic produce, and so that halves the price.
And sort of, you know, with those sort of key considerations, you sort of explained sort of a number of challenges that you face. Is there any other sort of key challenges that you face in terms of setting up or even running a food cooperative? You might have already covered them, but I just sort of check.
Yeah, so I mean, at the moment, because of the cost of living crisis and just rising costs of everything in general, it means that it's making it more difficult than ever to keep healthy food affordable to people. And so even though we've had to start using a new supplier, for example, we had to, because of our previous supplier having to stop their services for our non-organic range, they were significantly more expensive, but we didn't want to pass on that expense onto the customers. So we didn't increase the price of our fruit and veg. We've just had to absorb it as an organization. And because basically the way that it works is we put a price cap on the fruit and veg that we order. So if there's anything above that price cap, we don't get it delivered that week. So it means that everything that we have on offer is affordable to the local community. But then also we put on a margin which covers the cost of the original delivery price that our customers are used to, but also absorbs the cost of a few materials that we need to use, such as the brown plastic bags that people can use to decant their fruit and vegetables into. But it means that because this margin is so small compared to supermarket prices, it's still 15 to 20% cheaper, like I said. But because of increased supply costs and costs of other resources, it means that we are having to absorb those costs as an organisation. And because of our funding coming to an end in October, and also funding becoming more and more competitive to get secure and reduce amount of funding available, and more organisations going for it, it's just really competitive and really difficult. So we're having to try and find ways to make the food co-op more economically sustainable as a model, but that's really, really difficult when we're having to sort of tackle these issues head on, and it doesn't leave much time to be able to do this kind of strategy and trial out these things because we're very time pressured.
So Andrew, what did you take away from the interviews with Celia and Yolanda?
So firstly, I took away from these interviews is that the main aim of food co-ops is to reduce the cost of food through bargaining power, you know, through members coming together to enable them to have access to wholesale food prices. And, you know, speaking with Yolanda, there's clear evidence of this at St Hilda's Food Co-op, you know, with the fact that they've been able to reduce the cost of fruit and veg by around 15 to 20%.
Well, I learned that food co-ops come in all shapes and sizes, from small informal groups of that friends that come together to reduce their food bills, through to more formal groups that are running established shops. Some of them are very traditional, member-based models, drawing on sort of the cooperative principles of being member-owned and run, but also requiring people to pay a membership fee to access the services. But other are more, especially more recent groups, don't require that people have to become members to be able to buy food. But all of them have the same aim. They want to make food, especially fresh food, more affordable.
And I think in addition to, you know, the cost benefits of using a food co-op and also the benefits of having access to affordable fresh fruit, fresh food, you know, there are other sort of softer, more tangible benefits and outcomes to food co-ops. You know, food co-ops such as St Hilda's, you know, they seek to reduce their carbon footprint of the food that they offer, you know, to ensure that they're running a environmentally sustainable model. But there are also, you know, there are other benefits, including, you know, improving social cohesion between members of their local community and enabling people to develop employability skills through volunteering at these co-ops. And finally, also seeking to reduce food waste.
But for food cooperatives to be able to generate these sort of benefits, there are some key ingredients in place that need to be in place to help sort of the smooth running of these organizations. Some of them are technical, so they relate to food, more related to food retail, really, around food storage, quality assurance processes, and making sure you have data to understand your customers' shopping habits. Others are more generic. They might be more related to how you build a good organization. So having enough volunteers, having funding in place, and sort of good partnerships, especially with suppliers.
So to summarize, I think we can say there's two key points. The first being that food co-ops are diverse in the types of operating models they follow, but overall, all of them are seeking to reduce the cost of food. And the second point is that food co-ops rely on volunteers and good supply relationships, but can generate, at the same time, can generate a wide range of benefits.
That was the final episode of this series. Thank you for listening. Hopefully you've learned something about the nature of financial exclusion and the potential solutions. We will be back with another series very soon, so do stay tuned.
And that's the Innovation in Financial Inclusion podcast with Andrew and Paul. To find out more or to contribute to the discussion, go to hub.salford.ac.uk/CFS or follow us on Twitter at CFS_SBS. Bye for now.